Hi, I'm Millie. I grew up in the Netherlands where I became a journalist. Didn't last very long. I left to go and live in the United States and then ended up in Britain. Increasingly over time, so as a journalist, I became aware of not being able to voice what I saw as the truth. And so rather than pursuing journalism, I became an activist. And it's a fine line, isn't it? As an activist, you are better able to choose your narrative rather than as a journalist, you always have to find the grey middle ground, obviously. Whereas I'm quite a black and white person, you know, I kind of.
Well, you do have campaigning journalism. We have a very famous
Yes.
guy, Paul Foot, here in Britain, who was working on the Daily Mirror back in the pre-Murdoch days, who was pretty good. And then also, I mean, I have to sort of say something similar. It happened to me. I was working in mainstream journalism, trying to get more of the anti-establishment points of view in there. But then I suddenly found myself being interviewed by my old news editor as an activist in London at the Wandsworth Eco Village, live on the Newsroom Southeast as it was back then. So we've had similar journeys, you and I. And one of the things we've seen over Christmas is this amazing announcement by well, I thought it was quite interesting by Mark Zuckerberg, a Facebook boss, and he's a rather creepy character because these big things like Twitter and Facebook were all created as part of the surveillance state, really, in order to sort of get everybody that's chit-chatting on the internet into the same place so that they could be carefully watched and weeded out and this sort of thing. But he's now saying that he's going to really get rid of these fact checkers and there's going to be a massive reset in. And it sounds to me as if the whole thing's been a failure.
I think it's actually more dangerous, the policies that Meta or Facebook is adopting now, which is this kind of community standards. It's community led. I've already had a run-in with Facebook because a poster that was actually drawn up by the Dutch government during the COVID era, Mark Rutte did his big speech saying, "Oh, the prostitutes can go back to work," you know, during the COVID time. It's unbelievable that a prime minister would say like, "Oh, well, the prostitution industry can start operating again." And the Dutch government then issued a poster, which has become known as the Corona Sutra poster. You can look it up, you know, under your images. And it's a poster of approved sexual positions. Literally, I kid you not, which enforced the social distancing. So positions whereby you don't come face to face with your bed partner are fine, etc. Anyway, I posted this because it was so hilarious. I posted it back in 2021 or something. And just 2 weeks ago, Facebook suddenly said, "Oh, we've removed this poster because it breaches community standards." I'm like, "What?" So I wrote a post on Facebook saying, "Look what's happening here. You know, Facebook are removing this poster that was issued by the Dutch government. What is this?" And then I got slapped on the wrist by Facebook saying, "If you reoffend, we're going to close your account."
Yeah, they're threatening you. I mean, this is bizarre, isn't it? And also,
It's
of course, there's
moral
another
majority
aspect to
terrorism.
this so-called fact-checking. They're not checking facts at all. They're not doing community standards. What they're doing is what all evil people do, which is an attempt to rewrite history there, Millie.
Of course, and force a narrative. Talk about rewriting history, Tony. One of my favourite stories to people when they say, "Oh no, there was no censorship," or you know, "These fact checkers do a good job." There's a story I tell. We just mentioned investigative journalism. Back in 1994, I believe, was it Dispatches on Channel 4? The program, they had a story, and obviously this is pre-internet, so what was on television was your news, literally. That was your news, your information. There was a story that the World Health Organization had swooped, onto the Philippines in a previously unknown manner, normally when they said there was a tetanus outbreak. Now, normally, the World Health Organization would just set up a clinic somewhere and people would queue up, you know, one by one, they'd get a jab, et cetera. Not in this instance. They'd literally flown there with Boeings full of volunteers and they'd gone door to door jabbing people, but not all people. They literally only jabbed women of childbearing age. So not young children, not old women, not men. Only women of childbearing age. And of course, people got suspicious and there was a spate of miscarriages. And somebody managed to, a chemist managed to analyze the vaccine that they'd got hold of, the tetanus vaccine. And it turned out to be laced with an anti-fertility hormone called HCG. And so this big scandal broke. Channel 4 did this. If you cite this now, if you actually look it up, there is ample science written about it, that this happened in Kenya, in Nicaragua, in Mexico, the Philippines, Peru, everywhere where Bill Gates has had vaccine and the World Health Organization have had major vaccine campaigns. So Kenya, remarkably, has just actually removed the immunity from prosecution of Bill Gates. I don't know if you saw that story, but that is connected to this sterilization thing. Well, if you mention this on social media now, it is fact-checked and found to not be true. Well, it was true in 1994, you know, and it's still true in science.
It's interesting, isn't it, how this whole, and someone that, you know, like you, that's worked in mainstream media in Holland, look, in the old days, certainly our expectation was that we were the fact checkers and that if anything came out which was just untrue, nonsense, rubbish, that we had put forward as a fact, our heads would be on the block and we would lose our job. Now, I think in a way something strange has happened here in that it doesn't really matter if the journalists get it wrong, like, for example, weapons of mass destruction.
Yes.
What happens instead is those that call out the journalists. So, you know, at the time of the Iraq war, it was Andrew Gilligan, the BBC Today programme journalist, and it was the director general that had backed him, Greg Dyke, that they were sacked. So this is really like a sea change. So the idea is that the mainstream media seem to just lie whenever they feel like it for convenience. Yeah. And in a way, it's a sort of appetizing for the war or whatever they're trying to do. When the truth starts to pop out through social media, because people don't believe the mainstream anymore, they've got these little bots in there, individuals who are trying to stop the truth coming out through social media now, Millie.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, somehow or other, this has got into the mindset, the psyche, the very psyche of the population, to the extent that if you say anything that opposes the mainstream media narrative, the legacy media, as I think Russell Brand calls it, legacy media, doesn't he? If you say anything that counters that narrative, you're dismissed as right wing, you know, and the messenger gets shot rather than the message engaged with. So there is no debate possible anymore. You know, an example is, for example, an example is the Hunter Biden laptop story, which was mostly aired on Fox. There's some excellent American journalists called Matt Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger who blew open all that, the story of, you know, basically the stifling of the Hunter Biden laptop story. If that had come out pre the 2020 election, there's no way that Biden would have won. So much as Trump is in court for, you know, the whole Russiagate, which turned out to be completely false, as proven by the Twitter files. The Biden administration just gets away with it. As you say, there's, you know, the people who determine the narrative just get away with it. There's no repercussions for them.
Well, Musk taking over Twitter. This was quite an interesting, you know, because obviously there is masses and masses of news that people have posted on there over the years. Some people have had their accounts restored. In a nutshell, what do you think is the most important lesson from the Twitter files?
Just the FBI interference in, you know, the really blatant interference. And the same with Mark Zuckerberg. He at some point actually wrote a letter to the US Congress, didn't he? There had been congressional hearings during which he admitted that the fact checkers merely enforced approved opinions rather than actually checked facts. And he wrote this weird letter to Congress basically saying, oh, I succumbed to the pressure to let the security agencies dictate our policies, blah, blah, blah. So it's another Edward Snowden revelation, you know, first the NSA and now all these social media that I think on the Twitter board, how many former FBI people were on the Twitter board? So for people like you and I, you know, it merely confirmed what we already knew. It's just come out that Reuters was paid $300 million by the US, by the Biden government, to attack Elon Musk and to enforce a particular narrative. $300 million to Reuters, and everybody goes, no, Reuters, that's a prestigious, you know, news source. Well, clearly not anymore.
Well, know? Actually, if you look at closely at Reuters, and if you read books by their ex-employees, there are several out there. What you'll find is that Reuters' main business model is all based around share prices around the world. So they get most of their money from subscribers, business subscribers, so that they get instant. And if you pay like double, then you get the share price a few seconds before everyone else. That's their business model. So news is actually a sort of sideshow for Reuters. But look, we've got this whole situation with Donald Trump now. I think that's what's precipitating so much of this. The statement by Zuckerberg, the saying we've had enough of the fact checkers, because of Trump's threatened digital civil rights bill. I think it's actually just called the digital rights bill. The idea that actually it's constitutional that people should have freedom of speech, so even if they're wrong, they should be allowed to say it. And that's a principle it's set down in the US Bill of Rights. It's constitutional over there, which has been ignored for the last, well, at least sort of 5 years or so. So what do you make of Trump's arrival and what that might do to freedom of speech online and in the mainstream?
Goodness, there's a question, Tony. I would, first of all, I would say that this stifling of freedom of constitutional freedom of speech in the US predates the last 5 years. You look at somebody like Chomsky, you know, who was banned from publishing in America for a long time. What was his name? Aaron Schwartz, who supposedly committed suicide, who was campaigning against the J Store, having to pay for academic articles. He became quite the activist. Also, I remember in 2016, but that may have been still Trump, it became illegal to protest against Israel. So this, again, is a narrative where anti-Israel and anti-Semitism are conflated, and saying anything against Israel is then the crime, the hate crime of anti-Semitism. And it's all very, very confusing, isn't it? And equally, now Trump is back in charge. I'm an absolute advocate of the notion that free speech is a right, but it doesn't give you license to say hateful things. And you understand where I'm going, like how
Yeah, well, how do you the thing is, this is a difficult thing to define, isn't it?
Exactly.
I mean, certainly from a journalistic point of view, you know, I'm putting my old mainstream journalist head where we had millions, audience of millions, you know, on the turn of a phrase or whatever, is that you would just use a very simple test to see if something was sayable or not. And also maybe on a phone in or whatever to shut someone down if they were saying, which is if it's inciting criminality.
Yes, exactly.
So, you know, you can say something that might be considered hateful about a power. The other thing is this sort of sliding scale between the powerful and the not powerful. So someone who's claiming benefits, you know, you shouldn't be having a go at them. They're at the bottom end of society, but yes. your ire should be focused on the powerful at the top end of society.
Yes.
So those were the sort of two criteria we used to use on these kind of things: is it criminal, and are these people actually, do they have any power or not?
Yeah, quite. Well, that's the libel. That's what libel deals with, isn't it? The greater the reputation, the more open to criticism and scrutiny.
Is it factual? This is another thing which isn't always easy.
Yeah.
Well, we
do need fact checkers, absolutely. Like, I'm thinking back to certainly my lifetime. You know, once upon a time, X-rays were absolutely safe. They were the best thing since sliced bread. And then voices started getting heard saying, well, actually, this is radiation and this is damaging, et cetera, et cetera. And those people had to fight to actually be heard equally. You know, there was somebody saying vaccines cause autism. He got shut down. So advances in society take place by people campaigning, by voices coming in from the fringes saying, well, actually, look at this. Right. So we would never have known that X-rays were damaging unless those people had been able to express that.
In that instance, what you've got is you've got an industry which is starting to build up X-raying everybody, and then you've got someone here like a little you or a little me saying, "Hang on a minute, pregnant women, if these X-rays go anywhere near them, it damages the fetus." You know, this sort of thing, and there's a massive tug of war. The bigger picture here really is to do with science. And anyone that really understands science, particularly with reference to the climate, for example, will know that the science is never settled, that, you know, even somebody like Einstein may be very clever back in the 1940s or 30s. But, you know, a few decades later, a good scientist like him will understand that this is just a theory. You know, this is not a fact.
Exactly. Exactly. So there's I was actually taught this as an ever shifting paradigm, if you like. You have your thesis, you have your antithesis, and those two come together as a synthesis, and that synthesis then becomes a thesis. And, you know, and so this is change. This is evolution. This is progress. And just saying, no, this is the one and only truth. And that, of course, is what the fact checkers have been doing. This is the truth. Well, they don't own the truth. I don't own the truth. You don't. You know, my truths as a Dutch person are very different. I can't count the number of times people have said, oh, Holland, very liberal country. And I go, well, actually, you know, this is the truth about the decriminalisation of cannabis, for example. And people are amazed that there would be another narrative there. You know, so my truths aren't the same as everybody else's truths.
Well, can you just say something about that? Because you're right, there is a massive myth that, you know, that the Dutch have been extremely sensible and logical about cannabis, and that this hasn't led to the decriminalisation of more dangerous drugs. So what happened in Holland?
Well, it was basically so there was a massive black market, as there is in the UK. There was a massive drugs market that is all unregulated and untaxed. And tax is God in the Netherlands. So the government basically carried out this coup d'etat against the black market, and in one fell swoop brought it into a regulated industry where tax and VAT is paid, and I think they may even supply the cannabis to the coffee shops. You know, it's not at all a gesture of liberalism. It was a gesture of control.
Yeah. So anyway, what about climate? Just give us your take on that, because this has been a big area for the fact checkers. Oh, no. Every time you put the word climate in, it seems something will appear saying the climate. This is what this person meant to say.
Yes. I'm very, very worried. As a green person, I am a green, not a Green Party person, but I am truly, you know, Mother Nature is my mother. I find it extremely worrying that I challenge the CO2 narrative, which again is a control mechanism. It's taxing the air that we breathe. It's bringing in all kinds of ridiculous legislation and products. But my take is that the planet very urgently needs a lot of TLC. We need to stop dumping plastics and minerals in the oceans. We need to stop using so much pharma that contaminates our drinking water. All these kinds of common sense attitudes you now cannot talk about, because that's climate change denial. You know, it's like I said, like the Israel and the anti-Semitism is conflated. So climate change denial and common sense is kind of conflated. It's the most bizarre, or being right wing and, speaking up for, dismissing censorship. You know, those are all, I keep being reminded of, I was just actually reading, Tony, to prepare for this interview. I was reading about journalists who are currently imprisoned in the UK or arrested or in trouble. There's Sarah Wilkinson, who campaigned for Gaza. There's a man called Richard Medhurst, who refuses to give the journalist, who refuses to give the police his passwords for his phone. Somebody was arrested for wearing an anti-police T-shirt. Again, during the in the run up to the war in Iraq, the family of people who died in the 9/11 saga, they wore T-shirts saying "Not in my name." Do you remember that campaign? "Not in my name," and they were all arrested for being anti-government. So. I don't know. It's all it reminds me of Brave New World, of not Brave New World, of 1984, where somebody gets arrested for whispering in his sleep, "I hate Big Brother," and his children snitch on him. That's where we are. Absolutely.
Yeah, fat mad, isn't it, really? But I mean, a lot of this, I think, I wonder, I'd really love to just another awkward question for you. How much of this is just fear, the idea to spread fear, to shut people up, to get them to censor themselves?
Oh, totally. Absolutely, totally. I find myself doing it not so much out of fear of saying the wrong thing, more because I'm beginning to realize there's absolutely no point. Once somebody has taken position, there is no amount of evidence or inquiry that can change their minds. You know, people are still wearing masks, even though Fauci admitted in the US Congress he just made it up. He made up the social distancing. He made up loads of measures that there's absolutely no basis for. But people have got this fear narrative in their heads. Like, oh, people's breath is dangerous for my health, and they wear masks. You know, I have a story for you, Tony, from an anti-fracking camp called Barton Moss, which was in Greater Manchester, where we were strictly peaceful protesters against the worst police brutality that I've ever seen. Literally, where disabled people and women and children were targeted, all to, in our opinion, to rile the men into rioting against the police. And it just didn't happen. And eventually what they did was they trumped up this story, pardon the pun, of a flare having been fired at a police helicopter because there was a helicopter pad nearby and this flare had been fired, apparently. Well, there was no statement by the pilot. There was no witness accounts from people who lived nearby. Nobody had seen a flare. There was no recordings in that helicopter of a flare, but it made the front pages of all the newspapers. You know, protesters fire flare at police helicopter. So the whole opinion against the camp changed because we had endangered life. The police used it to raid the camp and throw all our warm things, because it was a really harsh winter. They threw all our bedding and stuff in the mud. And the funniest thing ever, they even dug over the poo pit. Obviously, we had compost toilets and these police were in charge of digging through the poo pit to see if there was a flare gun in there. But there never was a flare or a flare gun. And about 5 days later, there was a retraction on page 12 of The Guardian. And of course, nobody ever read the retraction. And that story of the flare that never was is still in people's minds. You know, and this is how it works. This is how the media work.
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, you would, the way you test a story like that as a journalist is you would, if the police haven't got any immediate evidence of something like that, the flare, then you would be putting that story out alongside people from the camp who were denying it and saying, well, no, we don't have any flares, no flare. You know, so you've got immediately, as soon as the news is out there, you've got another voice. But that doesn't really seem to happen hardly at all now. It's almost like a press release is just cut and pasted and put on the news.
Well, yes. You know, John Pilger, who sadly died last year, in his book, Heroes, he talks about covering the Vietnam War. And he said out of something like 700 journalists who were there, only three ever bothered to go to North Vietnam to check what the American U.S. Army press officers fed them every day. And he was one of those three. You know, and then, of course, in the Iraq War, we got the notion of embedded journalism, where you as a journalist, you could only go there with the full approval of the armed forces. And it's just got from bad to worse. In Germany, you said, are people scared to speak up? I just read an article by I think he's an American professor of something or other. He's writing, what is his name? Jonathan Turley. He's writing a lot about the suppression of free speech in the UK. And he also mentioned that in Germany, apparently only 20% of people feel free, even amongst family and friends, to express their opinions, to speak freely. That is really worrying, isn't it?
Yeah, and only 30%, according to the Press Gazette, of people in Britain actually trust what they read in the mainstream press now. So this is an all-time low. These things don't really get reported very much. The Press Gazette is excellent for anything on journalism. It used to be a little newspaper. I'd get it once. I think it was a monthly thing. It would come through the door, or maybe a weekly and then a monthly. And now it's just online, but it's brilliant. All sorts of interesting stuff. But you mentioning Vietnam reminds me, Colonel Lansdale, he was one of the American military, I think he would be a military attaché at the Vietnamese embassy before the war started back in the 1960s. And then there was suddenly a story appeared all over the Western world's press, which was that there'd been a fight and someone had been shot and killed at a picnic over there. And suddenly, of course, this sets up, it was a complete lie. There'd just been a normal picnic. Various people had, from the Vietnamese government and the Americans had been just having a picnic. But the lie spread around the world by the press. Suddenly this was the beginnings of this, what they call hardening the sides. So in other words, getting people to hate the North Koreans, love the South Koreans, blame the Americans if they had Vietnam, this was, in the 1960s. And then they had this thing, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which was where the Americans pretended that they'd been attacked by the North Vietnamese. And so there was a whole series of media events, which were all, should have been fact-checked, really. which led to the war. This is exactly what Julian Assange has been saying. You know, all the way through, really, he's been saying, well, look, we need to get the truth out, and that's the only way to stop these wars, Millie.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. I was thinking about, you know, fact checkers and Julian Assange, even saying, you know, free Julian Assange gets fact checked and conflated with supporting terrorism. It's just crazy. You know, it's just absolutely crazy. The as I said, this kind of moral majority, but it isn't, is it? It's very elusive. What is actually why can you not say that? Why can you not say anything against trans people without being accused of transphobia? You know, why during the Olympics recently, this Algerian who's clearly a man beat to a pulp this Italian woman boxer, and if you spoke out for the Italian lady boxer, you were considered unkind. Lots of my Facebook friends left me and said, we thought you were kind. Well, I should be kind to a man beating a woman? You know, and then this massive debate, and it all comes under the heading of, what is it, The Sky is Pink. And I don't know if you know the story of The Sky is Pink. It was a marketing campaign developed by a marketing agency that worked for the tobacco industry when they started coming under flak for, well, basically killing people with their toxic product. And they came up with this narrative of the sky, this policy of saying the sky is pink, because what you then do is you go, well, of course, everybody knows the sky is blue, but what if it was actually pink and you just see it as blue? And then you have debate, and then you don't have any certainty anymore. And this is where we are at now. We have a total lack of certainty. Even I doubt my own opinions. I doubt my own memories. I doubt my own perceptions, because, well, what if everybody else is right and I'm wrong? You know, is that not a healthy thing?
This is really interesting, isn't it? It's like your truth and my truth. Now, when I was working, I imagine when you were too, Millie, there was a truth that we were trying to get at, and it might be that people had different opinions on it, and you would give those. But this idea that everybody's got their own truth does kind of undermine the whole purpose of journalism.
Has it, though? Surely journalists help shape those truths, if the journalist can be trusted to, you know, to be discerning, and people of integrity like Pilger. You help shape other people's truths.
I mean, the truth might be we don't know. You know, the idea is, you know, it might be that this is one fact, here is another fact, they seem to contradict each other, but let's present them all.
Well, I think it's an absolute fact and truth that the biggest purveyors of disinformation are our governments. You know, the EU, the France, Canada, UK, the USA, Germany, the biggest purveyors of disinformation of all, and I'm saying disinformation, not misinformation. So I looked up the definition, because, again, that's confusing. Misinformation is when I say in the 1999 World Cup, you know, I get the year wrong and I confuse people or something. You know, it's just me accidentally giving out wrong information. Disinformation is deliberately stating false narratives with intent. That's the main thing, with intent. That's our government, and that's a fact. But I just read that under Priti Patel in 2021, there were plans to charge journalists under the Official Secrets Act and potentially give them 14 years in jail for attack for making the government look bad. Whatever happened to that? Was that dismissed? Was that incorporated in the Official Secrets Act?
Well, there's another thing called malinformation, which information that is true, but the government doesn't want you to know. So that's the one almost every morning, maybe you should be searching for that online to find out where it is. I want to press you a bit on Trump, because I'd like to get your opinion on it, because this is a new era coming in. We've got the changes in the information war, you might call it, and also, of course, the potential of ceasefires in Gaza and Ukraine. I suppose we better not hold our breath on either of those. But what do you make of the Trump phenomena?
I think for me, it's a mixture of hope and horror. Hope and horror, that famous firm of solicitors. Hope that if some of the things that he says are true, we can look forward to improvements. We can, I think Elon Musk is well and truly committed to free speech. But is that even true? Oh, I don't know. So the hope is that Trump will drain the swamp, as he calls it. And the horror is that, well, he's already come down on Hamas, basically threatening them and saying, you will free those hostages. I don't know. It doesn't fit with my ideology, Tony. Like, who does he think he is telling people in other countries what to do? This has always been my horror at the world. Like, why? What gave the Americans the right to interfere in the Sandinista revolution in Nicaragua? You know, but so on the one hand, on the one hand, great hope that some things might get better, and on the other hand, absolute horror because he is a horrendous individual. He just he turns my stomach. But there you go. He is the choice of the American people.
Well, that's democracy now. It's either, you know, Nutter A or Nutter B in charge.
Yes. But he's better than Nutter B. He's absolutely better than the, you know, senile, massively corrupt Biden family. Oh, my word. And Kamala Harris, how did she even get one vote? All I ever saw of her was her cackling on stage and coming out with nonsense. Not she couldn't utter a single full sentence.
Yeah, we've come to the stage, I mean, trying to drill into Trump a bit, that you've got such a moribund set of characters who, I mean, Biden really the worst you could imagine, this senile guy that can hardly speak. Even when he does, he can read an auto cue. He can't really say anything that's answer questions off the cuff. He gets it all wrong. He gets parts of the world wrong. He gets names, you know, of whichever war's happening or not happening all wrong. And at least, you know, when you're getting Trump, you're getting someone who's actually thinking on their feet. This is, you know, whether he's bad or good, he's not just an actor in a play reading out a script.
Yes, I agree. I totally agree. I think he's his own man. In a lot of ways, but is he really? My world view at the moment is that 1984 was not fiction but a script, and I think we are heading towards the three powers: Eurasia, East Asia, and Oceania, and the sounds that Trump is making are already putting that in place. He's talking about Canada as the 51st state. He's talking about annexing Greenland. A U.S. interference in Central America is already kind of turning all of that into a single continent, isn't it? Into a single administrative unit.
Well, what an interesting point, because, you know, the thing with George Orwell, I mean, I wouldn't say a script. I think he was an insider. He was from Eton. He'd worked at the World Service of the BBC, knew lots of people who were in very senior.
Did he not also work at the Defence, Ministry of Defence?
Yeah, he knew a lot. And I think, in a way, you know, he went up to the island of Jura in the Hebrides to write 1984, and then he died. So it, you know, far too young, and maybe he was bumped off. But the fact was, he managed to get that book out, saying, "I think this is what they're up to." So you think the sort of continental plans in 1984 are coming to fruition now, because he's managed to leak this out back in the 1940s, 50s?
Yes, I do. And I think if that assessment is correct, then the logical next thought is that Putin will indeed annex the EU, and the demise of the EU is blatant. You know, it's kind of plain for all to see that it's in its death throes. I mean, Germany, what was it? Austria has gone overwhelmingly right wing or something. And it's just, oh no, they cancelled elections, didn't they, last week? Anyway, I think Putin will, Russia and Europe will become Eurasia. That's my.
Well, that's what NATO has been trying to stop ever since the Second World War.
Well, no, it's what NATO has been trying to prompt, I think.
Really? I mean, they're trying to, I mean, that NATO is mainly an American operation to try and keep the Germans and the Russians apart, surely.
Well, is that even true anymore? Is not NATO maybe the catalyst to bringing this on? You know, is that maybe not that the whole good evil, obviously all good needs an evil to offset it. You know, God needs the devil. Beauty needs ugliness, etc. So Russia's always been evil, whereas we've been good.
No, hang on. The Russians were good in World War II. They were outrageous.
Exactly. Exactly. But they've never had that place in history, have they? In the historiography, it's never really been acknowledged what incredible sacrifice Russia made to... and in fact, the opposite, like the Russian soldiers came raping and killing and maiming. They were still the enemy, albeit on our side, more like the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of notion than actually, oh, the Russians are good. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, there was a bit of that, certainly. But I mean, we were supplying the Russians and they were the Eastern Front. We were the Western Front in World War II. But look, you're very well placed to tell us a bit about this guy Rutter, who's now in charge of NATO. Who is he? What's his politics?
He came out of absolutely nowhere. I think he was always a member of the Young Conservatives in the Netherlands. He conspired, well, conspired is maybe not the right word, but there's a big paedophile scandal in the Netherlands of a guy called Demmink. And Demmink was the equivalent of none other than Keir Starmer. He was director of public prosecutions. And he managed to disappear every investigation into himself or into his network of, you know, fellow pedos. So Mark Rutte and this guy Demmink and somebody else, they actually managed to get the age of consent in the Netherlands lowered to 12 at some point. And then that was undone, and it's anyway, that tells you a bit about him. I think he comes from a family of small business people, much like Margaret Thatcher. But he fell in with this student club called Minerva, which I've mentioned to you before. It's a student fraternity in Leiden. And unless you've actually joined that fraternity, you will never, ever amount to anything in the Dutch diplomatic service or the Dutch government. You know, you have to have had the say-so of the king who sponsors that organization. So Rutte came out of absolutely nowhere in 2007. He suddenly dwarfed in popularity a minister called Rita Verdonk, who was tipped to become the next prime minister. She was suddenly on some scandal, literally disappeared from the political scene. And Mark Rutte was propelled. Is that a word? Is it propelled?
Propelled,
into stardom. Now, this to me says very much the same as Justin Trudeau or Macron. Who are these people even? Where do they come from? And how all of a sudden are they, you know, in the forefront? So anyway, Rutte has been a quite popular prime minister, but like the other people that I mentioned, like Justin Trudeau, scandal after scandal after scandal that makes the government resign and makes him resign. And then wallop, he's back again. He's like a bad rash. You just can't get rid of the man. Now, when he lost the last elections to Geert Wilders, who is the Dutch neo-fascist, who I can't remember whether we've spoken about him before, but he's a I think we have. He's a chapter in his own right. He was funded by Pfizer and Microsoft, if you remember, through the Edmund Burke Foundation taking money from Microsoft and Pfizer to promote the extreme right wing in Europe. And in any event, Mark Rutte lost the elections to Wilders last year, or was it in 2023? And subsequently, while he was, what do you call it, a lame duck president, lame duck prime minister, there was a motion in the Dutch parliament to stop aid to Ukraine, to stop money going to Ukraine. And the motion was adopted, and Rutte stood there, no longer the prime minister of the Netherlands, saying, I don't care that you've adopted this or that you voted for this. I am not going to carry out this motion. In other words, I am the tyrant. I decide. Next thing, he was tipped as the Secretary General of NATO. But there was a condition to it. And the condition was that his party, his Tory party in the Netherlands, would not support the government of Geert Wilders. And Geert Wilders are funded by the Zionists now, by Israel. So it's a huge cesspit of, I don't know, international playbills and international money and interests. And it's very hard. But Rutte is, he's as slimy and as slippery as he gets.
Well, it makes him perfect to start World War III, maybe. Anyway, look, if you go back a bit further in Dutch history, there was this guy called Pim Fortuyn, was it?
Pim
Fortuyn, and in 2002 he was assassinated. So it's interesting. I mean, a similar sort of thing seems to have happened during that period in the UK with the UK Nationalist Party. We had the BNP, yes. British National Party, and Nick Griffin leading that. He wasn't actually assassinated, but he was ousted from the BNP because he refused to support the Zionists. So who was this Pim Fortuyn guy?
He was a lawyer. I didn't live in the Netherlands at that point. I remember I was on a bus in Cuba, no less, with my 8-year-old daughter. And these Dutch people heard my daughter and myself speak in Dutch, which we imagined was our secret language. And all of a sudden, these Dutch people lean over and go, have you heard they've murdered Pim Fortuyn? And I'm like, who's Pim Fortuyn? Like, you know, just absolutely no clue. But he was a lawyer who started the whole anti-immigrant noises. He was also gay and a massive drama queen. He was unbelievably camp, but a drama queen, causing, not behaving in a manner befitting a parliamentarian, for example, literally just drama in the House of Commons. Who was he murdered by? He was murdered by somebody purporting to be an animal rights activist, I think, but it was a very, very strange story. There's been investigations and there's been all kinds of strange conclusions about the absence of security. Like, you know, why did all the systems fail to actually keep Pim Fortuyn safe? So Pim Fortuyn was at the big media center in the Netherlands in Hilversum. It's where all the television is based. And he'd been there for an interview. And when he came out, he was shot. So on the back of his rise to fame, I mean, people thought he was Jesus. Literally, he had unbelievable following, like stardom kind of following, if you like, not even politically politically motivated stardom, but celebrity style stardom. His party then became known as the LPF, which was the List of Pimford Town, and they were politicians trying to carry on his legacy and his ideology. They all ended up arguing amongst themselves and falling out and lost. I think they may have actually been in government in 2003, 2004, but because they were so incoherent and they didn't last very long. And then out of that came the party of Geert Wilders. So, who is now, you know, the leading party in the Netherlands, the anti-immigrant, very much national socialism. You're not allowed to say that. The fact checkers would pull me up on that, but he is national socialism.
Thanks ever so much again for helping us through the fact check, Maya. I wonder, is there anything else you want to add?
Well, something that really worries me is how incredibly humorless all this is. Apparently there's a Scottish guy in prison for calling his girlfriend's new Irish boyfriend a leprechaun. And that was classed as a racial slur. And he's in prison for hate speech for calling an Irishman a leprechaun. You know, this thing about the Corona Sutra poster that I mentioned, how incredibly humorless to say this breaches community standards. It was funny, you know, and I think our ability to laugh is being eroded along with our ability to think for ourselves. And that's really very worrying.
Yeah, well, the satirists maybe are the revolutionaries, not just the farmers. We shall see. All right, Minnie, thanks very much for joining us. Is there anywhere people can follow you if they're interested in on social media somewhere?
I've been withdrawing from social media for the very reason that, you couldn't really express yourself there.
You keep threatening to do that.
Well, I'm actually about to start a social media profile for my eco project, and that will be called, I think, I'm looking for a fitting name, but I think it will be called La Brunelle, which is the French for the little plant of self-heal. In the Latin name is Prunella vulgaris. And it's a very important plant, and it's one that Mother Nature is said to give us in our environment what we need. And last year saw a glut of self-heal absolutely everywhere. So it's clear that the world needs this. And as and when, Tony, I will let you know my social media identity. And if people wanted to support my eco project, that'd be very welcome.
Jungle Bus Millie Michaela Smith, I'm not sure what we should be calling you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you for having me, Tony.